This Adams Division podcast is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Here's Park, the draw, the shot. It's trickles in. It's knocked away. Park with it. Scores! Brad Park wins the game. Brad Park, a rebound. And the Bruins win 3-2.
To LaFontaine. He gets tripped up. Gets it to May. And over the line. He's May going in on goal. He shoots. He scores!
Once again, days have turned into weeks and weeks have turned into months, but finally, the Adams Division podcast has returned. I am your co-host, Steve Bennett, along with my main man, Peter Winson. What's up, Peter?
Oh, it's great to be back talking, you know, talking sports and getting the Adams Division podcast booted up again, because our last one was in June and we're now near the end of the summer, so maybe we'll kick up the schedule at some point.
And we're like, yeah, we'll be back in a week to finish this off for sure, you know, 1 week we'll finish it, and then we didn't. we're here now. So the business at hand is part two of our 10 favorite sports teams of our lifetimes. Or even before that, I guess. You could have had someone before your lifetime on the list, I suppose. But we went over 10 through 6 on the last episode, part 1, and today we'll do 5.1, or 5 to 1. We'll go over who our 10 to 5 was in a second, but what we're going to do is we're going to do 5 and 4 in a minute, and then we'll take a break. We'll do 3 and 2, and then we'll take another break. And we'll reveal our number ones. But quickly before we do that, we always want to let everyone who's nice enough to listen to the Adams Division podcast know they can listen to Peter and I on our other podcast. So quickly, my main show, this is my side piece. My main girl is the Sportscasters. You can find out more information about it at sports_casters. Email me for questions about it to sportscasters@gmail.com. And find it wherever you find this podcast. You can probably find that one. My latest episode just was released today as we record this, and it featured Stuart Mandel and Mike Triplett. I am interviewing Richard Deitch on Friday, who will be a part of the next podcast, and I'm still working on a very big figure in the wrestling podcast world who needed to delay our interview to get past an event that he has on Labor Day weekend. Hint, hint. and when that completes, we will be able to get some time to do that. So that's where I'm at with the Sportscasters. What's up with greetings from Allentown?
Well, greetings from Allentown. I'm trying to keep myself in the correct time frame between when we're taping this and when it will drop.
Yeah, who knows?
the episode that I am releasing very shortly after we're taping this is episode 132 on Central States All-Star Wrestling from Kansas City. As I said on the Place to Be podcast, hold your applause, America, on that one. It was interesting, meeting some of the characters that I had never really seen before. But there were a few familiar faces, like a Buzz Sawyer, and Kerry Von Erich magically appears because World Class had sent in a tape and they just aired it on the Kansas City show. But for my next episode, 133, I'm going to be taking a look, and I did a little poll on this on my Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, a August 1991 WWF show, and the vote came in, and it's going to be the August 12th, 1991 primetime wrestling that features the Macho Man Randy Savage's bachelor party.
Oh, very fun.
What an event that is. I watched it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and It is a tour de force. There's no studio audience for that. It's just everybody kind of screwing around, and oh my God, it's everything you could have wanted and more.
Now, Peter was just on the Place to Be Nation podcast, the flagship, and I'm going to be on September 30th for the January of 1990 show at MSG. So if you enjoy us here and you would like to listen to us with Justin and Scott, Peter's on every time they do a Saturday Night Live or Saturday Night's main event. And I'm on every few, you know, I'm in the rotation, as they say, of the house shows.
Yeah, they don't let me do the house shows because I'm too long-winded. The Saturday Night's main event is actually the best fit for me anyway, because it's a shorter show. You need somebody to stretch it out, make Lanny Poffo jokes, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you were all over Lanny on this last one. Oh, man. I like Lanny. I know you like Lanny, too. You're good-hearted jokes.
I do.
Yeah, no, he was... I was glad for him that, you know, that he had that moment with the genius. Okay, before we get too sidetracked, because we had to cut this one off because it got so long. The original plan was we were just going to do 10 to 1, but we got so long-winded that we had to cut it off and split it in two parts. Now, these are the teams that I had 10 to 6, and then Peter will give you his. At number 10, I had the 93-94 New York Rangers. At number 9, I had the 1989 Oakland Athletics. Number 8, I had Sam Bradford's 08-09 Oklahoma Sooners football team. Number 7, I had the 2011-2012 New Orleans Saints. And at number 6, I had the world champion 1995 Atlanta Braves. Peter?
And for me, at number 10, I had the 1993 Atlanta Braves, so a two-time defending NL champion that didn't get back to the World Series, but I certainly enjoyed them more for various reasons. Go back and listen to part one if you haven't already listened to it. At number 9, I had the 1990 Cincinnati Bengals, notable for being the last Bengals team to win a playoff game. Number 8, the 1995 Houston Rockets for their historic playoff run, beating four different teams that had 50 wins in the regular season. I still think they're the only NBA team to accomplish that feat. At number 7, the 2004 curse-busting Boston Red Sox. And at number 6, the 2001 New England Patriots, victorious in Super Bowl 36 over the St. Louis Rams.
All right, now before we get going on our list this week, I have to talk real quickly about an oversight I made. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not really sure why I did this. See, because like when you make an oversight for a team that would probably be in your top five, you can't do anything once you've done the bottom 10, because you wouldn't take out a top five team. Like I would have taken out probably the Rangers at number 10 would have dropped, and this everyone would have fell a spot, and this team would have been somewhere in the top five. But I screwed up. I don't know how I forgot them. But the 2006 Italian national soccer team, winners of the World Cup, would absolutely be somewhere on my list. Just a simple oversight mistake when I was making the list. I just let it slip my mind. But I've told the story before. In 1994, I watched the final with my grandmother, great-grandmother, actually, who was from Italy. And when Roberto Baggio sailed the ball over the net, she cried. And I said, "Grandma, why are you crying? You don't even like soccer." And she said, "I am just a sad for Italy." So she was sad for Italy. And then in 2006, a thrilling team that only let up one goal that wasn't a penalty. And Buffon and Pirlo and all the great players on that team. And then when they won against France, me and my brothers went to Grandma's grave and gave her a flag and let her know Italy was happy once again. So I oversight, my bad. Sorry, 2006 Italian national team. You would be in the top five somewhere.
It's nice to get a reminder about that World Cup, because I remember 02 very well for the U.S.'s run, and I remember 2010 in South Africa for those obnoxious horns that played throughout all the games. '06, I mainly only remember for that Zidane headbutt, which may have been in the final. I don't recall.
It was in the final. Yep. Actually, I believe it was an extra time of the final, believe it or not. So he could not take a penalty.
Yeah.
All right. I guess I will kick us off. Number 5, right? That's where we're at. Number 5. I have the 1992-93 Buffalo Sabres.
That hurts.
Really cool team. Yeah, really cool team. They were led by Alexander Mogilny, who scored 76 goals that year. Not enough to lead the league by himself, because Timo Solani scored 76 as well. Pat LaFontaine was dominant. And for the first time, essentially in my lifetime. And I think they had won a first round series when I was a baby. But for the first time in my life as you know, a fan, they advanced out of the first round when they beat the Bruins in four games. And I think at least three of them were overtime. Definitely the last one. I know Bob Sweeney scored an overtime goal in Boston. And didn't Yuri Himalev score an overtime goal maybe in that series too? Or
I believe so, yes. Yeah. There were three overtime games. And you know how I know that is because the fourth game that did not go to overtime, I actually attended that one, which was a 4-0 loss for the Bruins in the old garden.
And then maybe the even more interesting thing is the Sabres went on to play the Canadiens, who would go on to win the Stanley Cup. And they lost in four games, but every game was 3-2.
Yeah.
And Alexander Mogilny broke his leg in the series, which essentially ruined their chances. But every game was one goal, same score, and a few overtimes. If you remember, the Canadiens went 10-0 in overtime that year on their way to the Cup, which is incredible to win, you know, 10 overtime games in the playoffs. It's silly. But yeah, just a really fun Sabres team. The first time they won a playoff series in my lifetime. You know, Mogilny, anytime you'd go to a game and he touched the puck, it's like people would, you know, move up their seat a little bit. Because he was always a threat to score. Anytime you get 76 in a year, you are. Pat LaFontaine was over 150 points for the year. Just a really cool team. Fond memories of them. I was at the May Day game, me and my dad. I actually had my first communion the day before. I made my first communion a little bit late because of hockey requirements the year that I was supposed to make it. So I finally got around to making it, and as part of my gift, my dad said, all right, let's go to the game tomorrow. We went down, and there was only standing room only seats. So I got we got standing room tickets, and during the overtime, I was sitting on the steps of the oranges, which was the top section of the odd. I was just sitting on the steps next to some random lady who was willing to allow me to sit next to her there watching. And I remember in between the third period in the overtime, my dad bought me some M&Ms, and I had the bag of M&Ms. And when Brad May scored, I remember throwing the M&Ms like up in the air, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, just a really, you know, just a fun team. Glad to have them number five. They feel appropriately ranked there.
If you think back, and after all, this is the Adams Division podcast, when the NHL had things arranged the way they did with the Adams and the Norris and the Patrick and the Smythe, and they had the top four teams make the playoffs in each division, that Sabres team might have been the best fourth place team out of, I mean, I obviously I don't know every year's standings for 11 years, but I would say that that Sabres team might have been the best fourth place team because that division was stacked. The Bruins were well over 100 points, and so were the Canadiens and the Quebec Nordiques. Quebec and Montreal playing in the first round. So the Sabres kind of, you know, under the radar a little bit with those other teams. And indeed, they did break my heart because I saw that 93 Bruins team as the best chance to win a Stanley Cup in my lifetime to that point because they had a healthy Cam Neely, relatively healthy for that playoffs. And he did score, I think, about five or six goals in the four games. The problem was Andy Moog kind of sucked for the Bruins. And this, as I said, the Sabres, they were not really a fourth-place team. You could have dropped them in one of the other divisions, and they probably would have finished higher, I think.
And I think it's one of those series, too, where if you play it again, it might be a sweep the other way because sometimes those overtime games are kind of a coin flip, you know, when you get to that point of the game, when you have three of the four in overtime, you know.
That's true, although that 4-0 game in Boston, I just remember that being completely hopeless. And it was the second playoff game that I had ever been to. And, you know, my birthday's in late April, so I would ask for a ticket, you know, tickets to a playoff game for the first round or the second round as my birthday gift. The year before, I had seen the Bruins play the Sabres in the playoffs, and the Sabres won 2-0. And then the next year I go, and the Sabres win 4-0. So
party
I kind
papers.
Of... I kind of started thinking, well, is this could this possibly be my fault? And as it turned out, the Bruins lost the first seven playoff games that I attended. So it wasn't only a Buffalo Sabres thing. It was a bunch of other factors.
You got me thinking. I wonder if this if that May Day game was my first playoff game. Now that you say that, I wonder if that was my first playoff game. Probably was.
They didn't have so many chances because they did miss the playoffs a bunch in the late 80s. And up to a certain point, the first round was a best of five, although you would have been really young because I think 86 was the last year that they had the best of five in the first round. So if you didn't have home ice, you could play the entire regular season and only have one home playoff game at the end of it.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that probably was my first playoff game. Good way to go. I mean, it's an iconic game for sure. Certainly in Buffalo, it's iconic. And yes. I mean, the call is what almost makes it as iconic as it is. The Rick Jeanneret Mayday call, which is one of the great sports calls of all time.
And probably the most famous Buffalo Sabres game, even though they've made the Stanley Cup final in 2009. Certainly their most famous win. Maybe not their most famous game.
Right, that's probably the no-goal game.
Yeah.
All right, what do you got for number five? Because we'll have more Sabres later.
For number five, I go back to my early childhood, the 1986 Boston Red Sox. Mm. The first baseball team that I remember really well, although I went to a playoff game. I mean, I went to my first game at Fenway Park in 85, but that team finished 81-81 and was as bland as, you know, the record would indicate. In 86, you got the Roger Clemens breakout, winning 24 games. People forget that he underwent a season-ending shoulder surgery the year before, and there was a thought that potentially his career was going to be sidelined, and then he managed to hang around and pitch for another 22 years amid great controversy. Wade Boggs, I mean, a guy who was totally not appreciated in his era. Automatic 200 hits at least every year, hitting 357 in 86, which was the lowest during that time frame that he had. Jim Rice, his last great year in a Red Sox uniform. And there was so much to see. And it was the first year that I went to, you know, quite a number of games. And seeing my team make the playoffs at such a young age, I thought, oh, well, is it always going to be this way? Well, no. And with the way the Red Sox were in that era, thank God, because when you get to the 86 playoffs, you get the most dramatic of comebacks against the Angels when you're down three runs in an elimination game in a game five.
Was that Dave Henderson?
That would be Dave Henderson. And if you're gonna watch one baseball game, you know, ever, and you don't even have to watch the entire game, just check in on that game starting in the sixth inning and through the ninth, because the Angels should have won that game in the bottom of the ninth after the Henderson home run, but the Red Sox pitched out of it. And then, of course, there's the World Series, which, I mean, that's chapter and verse. As a 7-year-old, I went to bed the night of game seven with the Red Sox leading 3-0 in the fourth inning, and then woke up the next day and nearly crapped my pants when I saw the final of 8-5. I'm like, what the hell happened here? And, you know, you could have just said, well, that's the Red Sox. And that was pretty much the case from 1919 to about 2003, where those things would happen. But it was such a fun team. I mean, they got Tom Seaver as their trade deadline acquisition. I mean, how cool is that? He wraps up his career in a Red Sox uniform, and unfortunately, he got hurt and didn't get a chance to pitch in the playoffs. Unlikely heroes, you mentioned Dave Henderson. Spike Owen contributed as the utility shortstop that they brought in a waiver deal as well. Just a really, really fun team that I look back on fondly, despite the way that it ended.
The interesting thing about the 86 baseball season, I guess, for me, is that the 1985 Royals are the first champion I remember knowing about. Like, I remember playing in the yard and talking about the Royals and George Brett being the champions. Now, 86 is the first World Series I remember watching games. Like, I remember sitting down and watching parts of that World Series. And let me ask you this. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but wasn't there a rain delay between games 6 and 7?
There was. And actually, that kind of go. I'm glad you bring that up, because game 7 was supposed to be started by Oil Can Boyd. It was his regular start, but he was awful in game 3. And with the extra day, they decided to go with Bruce Hurst on 3 days rest, which is probably the right decision, except Oil Can kind of went on a bender, and he was known for that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, when he wasn't chosen for the All-Star game in 86, he was so upset about it, he left the team for about 3 or 4 weeks, which I had forgotten about until I watched an old YouTube video from the time period. I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. Oil Can Boyd literally went AWOL in 1986 in the middle of the season playing for a first-place team because he was mad that he didn't make the All-Star team because he had 11 wins. Well, of course, now we know wins is a function of something else, but he was still a pretty damn good pitcher that year, and he pitched the division clincher in September against the Blue Jays, a game that I was – lucky enough to attend. It was a blowout, and the number one thing I remember was Wade Boggs on the horse, which was years right before everybody decided to lionize him for being on a horse because the Yankees won the World Series. It's like, I've seen that before.
We're not even going to get into the Mookie Blaylock stuff, but man, could you imagine, every time someone poses this question, what sporting event would you wish Twitter was around for? The 86 World Series always comes up.
Oh, you mean Mookie Wilson when you?
Oh yeah,
Mookie,
what did I say? Blaylock? Yeah. Oh yeah, Pearl Jam in my mind.
Yeah,
meant Mookie Wilson. Of course, Mookie Wilson. Mookie, and of course Buckner. But man, could you imagine Twitter? Whew.
I mean, it's a Boston, New York thing. Anytime those two cities have something in a playoff setting. It's definitely going to be amplified.
The last time the Mets won the World Series too, right? Then they weren't in it again until 15. Oh, they were in 2000 against the Yankees. Yeah.
Well, don't worry. That one's forgettable. And I think 15 is going to mostly prove forgettable as well.
Was that the Royals? Royals, right?
Yeah. That was the Royals. Yes.
Interesting. All right. Anything else on them?
No, that's it on the 86 Sox.
All right. Number four was really close to being number one, and that's the 2018-2019 New Orleans Saints. Man, what a team. What a fun team. Just week one, a little bit of a disaster. They lose to the Bucks. Week two, they almost lose to the Browns. Yeah.
They almost lost two games at home to start the season against bad teams.
But then all of a sudden, it just clicked, and they went on a run, and they would pummel teams. And they would just come out and they would score right away, like on the first drive, touchdowns. And man, they were good. And then they played the Cowboys on like a Thursday night and didn't win and weren't very good. The Cowboys had a good plan, kind of slowed them down a little bit. They didn't play anyone the last week. And they win a playoff game the following week, in 2 weeks, they had the bye, win the playoff game against the Eagles, and then obviously the disaster of the NFC Championship game. But wow, what a great team. Love everything about them. Love the stars of the team. You know, Drew Brees, Kamara, and Cam Jordan, and Mike Thomas. These are awesome, really fun New Orleans Saints. Just a really cool team that if they would have finished the deal, probably would have been my number two team on my list. But instead, they're here at four, which is really high. And one of the more interesting things about them is when the playoffs started, I said to Tammy, I said, you know, one thing about the playoffs this year, which gives me pause to relax, is that it can't end worse than last year. And of course,
hold my beer.
I was dead wrong. So a really tough way to end. And it's something I really want to put behind me, but know that I can't, that it won't. It's not going away, at least not this year. They had a preseason game and on CBS, and I watched a quarter and a half, and they mentioned the final play of the interference, non-interference play three different times by the middle of the second quarter. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a long year. But great team. Love them. Disappointed they didn't have a chance to play the Patriots in the Super Bowl. But didn't work out, didn't go our way, we didn't get the call, and we couldn't finish it off in overtime. So doesn't take away for how much I loved them and how much I enjoyed watching them play every week, and just what a fun season it was. So hats off to the 2018 New Orleans Saints, my number four team.
And they were, like you said, they were laying the lumber to everybody during about an 8-week stretch in the middle of the season. And to give everybody a peek behind the curtain, I recall there was one game where the Saints played Cincinnati, and I think they won like 51-14. It was just a total joke of a blowout. And I texted you for the first time. I said, boy, I am not looking forward to the inevitable Patriots loss to the Saints in the Super Bowl. And it came so very close to actually happening, if not for that one thing, which shall remain unspoken. But the Patriots may have lucked out there not facing that Saints team, although it would have been an interesting matchup the way the Patriots are playing defensively against that Saints offense, the way they were going.
It's interesting.
But yeah, hell of a fun team.
And interesting that back to back we have teams that maybe suffered the darkest moments in their history, right? Like you had the 86 Red Sox, very dark moment there, and then I have the 2018-19 Saints who end with a very dark moment as well.
So. Yep.
All right, what do you got for number 4?
All right. So number 4, I had debated whether I could actually include this team on the list, and I said, you know what, screw it. They kind of played a season in the summer of 1992, and I'm talking about the 1992 U.S. men's basketball team, the original Dream Team. And how could you not love a group that has Jordan, Magic, Bird, Barkley, and of course Christian Laettner, all on the same team? You're able to root for these guys that you root against during the regular season. It was a chance to see Magic play basketball again after, you know, he had to retire before the previous season with HIV. I mean, what a fun time that was, where they had to qualify for the Olympics by playing in that Tournament of the Americas, and they were just pounding the crap out of teams. I mean, some of the final scores, I should actually probably have these committed to memory, because I remember the gold medal game against the Croatia was the closest game that they played, and the final score was 117-85. That was the closest game that they played out of everything that they played. It's just the legendary stories of them in Monte Carlo, the famous intramural game where, you know, they went at it tooth and nail. I mean, I can't get enough in talking about that team. And I made sure that was appointment television for all of their games in the Barcelona Olympics and even in the Tournament of the Americas.
On the Sportscasters, we feature books. And one of my favorite books in the history of the Sportscasters is a book called Dream Team by Jack McCollum, the Hall of Fame NBA writer. Incredible book, an incredible story. And the NBA Network actually did a documentary kind of piggybacking off the book, which is also called Dream Team, I believe, which is awesome. Wow, what a story. I think 11 Hall of Famers out of 12. And Christian Laettner, not a Hall of Famer, but college basketball Hall of Famer and a very good player. And it's also an interesting story on how he kind of ended up on the team, how initially they were going to do 6-6, and it ended up, you know, being 11-1. But just, yeah, interesting. I remember them having like a tie-in at McDonald's. This is like back when, you know, I guess I was 11, and I love going to McDonald's with my, you know, my little brothers and stuff, and Dream Team was everywhere, you know, on the cups, on the French fries. I always remember that for whatever reason. But yeah, for someone who doesn't really care much for basketball, this is a really cool team and a really fun story. And yeah, kick ass. And it's interesting because right now they have the anti-Dream Team playing. Right? Maybe the worst U.S. basketball team since they started having pros and stuff. It's playing right now somewhere.
But here are the Olympic final scores. I mean, this is actually the last games that Larry Bird played in his career, was in these Olympics. And he was just kind of like a stand out at the 3-point line and shoot threes. So he was actually kind of more of a modern player in kind of his crippled state that he was. Here are the final scores for their 8 Olympic games. I had mentioned the Croatia gold medal game, 117-85. Angola versus Angola, 116-48.
Wow.
the That's the famous game where throwing elbows at poor Angolan players. Croatia 103-70. So that was a pretty close one. 33. Germany 111-68. Brazil 127-83. Spain 122-81. Puerto Rico 115-77. Actually, is that the close? No, that was 30 something points. And Lithuania, who's a very strong team, 41-point blowout, 127-76. And it cannot be understated what that team, I think, did for international basketball in terms of, all right, this is the standard we're setting, and just the attention that they brought to the sport in other countries, because there's so many more international players in the NBA now versus in 1992. Sure, there were trailblazing players back then, but now it's much more commonplace, and I think it traces back to that dream team. And it is amazing how quickly the rest of the world did catch up. It only took till what, the 2004 Olympics for the U.S. to lose.
But that's the only one they've lost, right? They've won every one except 04.
Yeah, they regrouped in 08 and basically went with kind of a reboot with LeBron and Kobe and other guys, as I recall. Anyway,
the Coach K era. It's kind of started after that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, a really cool team, and I totally recommend that book by Jack McCollum called Dream Team. If you haven't read it, it's worth your time. It's one of the great sports books I've read, and I've read a lot of them. But really cool stories in there, like about how when they played Croatia, Tony Kukoc was on that team, and Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan wanted that ass bad. Like, they were not going to let him play. They were all over his shit. And they were, like, fighting over to be the one who would annoy him. So, yeah, really cool stuff.
Oh, I mean, Jordan.
The gambling stories.
Jordan is such a legend on so many levels, but I love the fact that he was going to refuse to participate in this if they put Isaiah Thomas on the team. He froze Isaiah off that team in retaliation for Isaiah. When Jordan was at the 85 NBA All-Star game, the Eastern Conference guys led by Isaiah froze MJ out, and he's got a long memory. It's six, 7 years later when they were deciding who they were going to put on this team. He's still holding that grudge against Isaiah. Oh, I love it. It's so great.
That is awesome. Yeah, what a great team. Good call. I like that one. I like that one for sure. All right, so we're going to break now, correct?
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break. The Adams Division Podcast, just getting going here. We each got three teams left, the big three on each list. We will be right back. Adams Division Podcast is back. I'm Steve Bennett. Peter Winston with me here. We're counting down our top 10 favorite sports teams of all time. Still a little bit of business to do. We have number 3 and number 2 before we take another break. And also in between 3 and 2, we're going to spin the dial a little bit and talk about our most hated team of all time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I will kick us off. Number 3, the 2005-2006 Buffalo Sabres. What a squad. It's interesting because the Sabres kind of lucked into this team because of a hunch that their general manager had. The general manager at the time was like, you know what? I think that this team, that this league is going in a different direction. He kind of looked out. He anticipated that there'd be a work stoppage, maybe not as long as it was. And he anticipated that coming out of that, there'd be a new set of rules that created that emphasize speed and skating and special teams. And because of that, the 2005-2006 Sabres became one of the best teams in the league. And it happened right in front of our eyes over the course of the season. There was actually a game early in the season against the Ottawa Senators in Buffalo, and Ottawa won 10-4. And they whooped our ass. And then the last time that Ottawa came to Buffalo before the playoffs, the Sabres won 3-2. Maxim Afinaganov scored in overtime, and it was a big game because it gave the Sabres the belief that they could beat Ottawa. They went into the first round of the playoffs. I was at game one with my brother Greg, and it's famous for two things. One, Danny Briere won in double overtime on his 13th shot of the night. And two, Jay McKee killed RJ Umberger in a hockey game. One of the great hits of all time. And then they went on and they beat Ottawa in five games, three overtime wins. Chris Drury scored in a 7-6 thriller to open that series, where they went back and forth and back and forth. And then in game two, they won a close game in Ottawa, and unfortunately Tim Connolly got hurt, and Dmitry Kalinin got hurt in that game, which is the start of the attrition of this team. And then in game three, J.P. Dumont won a game in overtime, where if you get to see the CBC feed, you can see John Muckler throw his cup in disgust at the wall, which is awesome. And then Jason Pominville won it in Ottawa on a shorthanded goal, where the Ottawa goalie, who just drowned, what's his name? Why can't I think of his name? Rest in peace. He just drowned.
Ray Emery.
Ray Emery, thank you. For some reason, didn't poke check and let Pominville just skate around him and stuff it in there. And then the devastation of the conference finals, where every time they won a game, they lost a defenseman. I was at game six of the conference finals. Again, Danny Briere scoring in overtime. He kind of bookended the home playoff games with overtime winners. And man, I wish everyone listening to this could have been with me to walk out of the building that night. Our arena, you kind of walk in the front and there's this big atrium with escalators on both sides of it where you go up to go to the seating. And if you go up to the 300 level, there's two sets of us. You know, you got to go up to the 100, then you go on the escalator again, you go up to the top. So we were in the 300s and we're going down the escalators and it's just getting louder and louder. And we want the cup chance and let's go Buffalo chance and just scream. It was the coolest, one of the coolest like civic pride moments in my life. Just to be a Buffalonian, to be there for that. And then, of course, I woke up a couple days later to find out Jay McKee had a staph infection. And we'd have to play the conference finals with game seven with defensemen, organization defensemen 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And they had a lead going into the third period.
Yeah.
God. And just couldn't quite close it out. Rory Fitzpatrick did Rory Fitzpatrick things, leaving the puck between his legs for Rod Brendamore to score the go-ahead goal. But, man, what a team. What a run. I stand by 100% the fact that they would have absolutely won the Stanley Cup if they would have made it.
Yeah,
they just couldn't get over that last game. That Jay McKee infection was like the one injury they just couldn't withstand. But what a cool team. Chris Drury, Danny Briere, Tim Connolly, who I will fight with anyone, was the best player in the world at the time. A fourth overall pick, becoming the superstar everyone thought he could be. Man, what a team. My favorite Sabres team of all time. Worthy of the number three spot for sure.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to name the six defensemen who played in Game 7 of the conference finals when they were down to it, but it was pretty much just Brian Campbell and a bunch of scrubs.
Yeah, Doug Janik.
Doug Janik, Jeff Gilson, Nathan Paish.
Nathan Paish.
Who had played one game in that regular season. He's thrown in there in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Now, you had mentioned they had a lead going into that third period, and with the game 2-2 mid-third, a puck over the glass penalty
to
Campbell. Yep. So the worst person it could have happened to, since he was, I mean, with all respect to Tony Lidman, the best defenseman that they had. I'm still of the belief that the 07 Sabres the following year were the superior team. They did finish with three more points than the 06 team, but You know, they did kind of flame out in the second round against Ottawa. So
no, that was the conference finals. They won two rounds. They beat
that's right.
They beat the Islanders and the Rangers. You know what happened to Ottawa was what we were talking about earlier with the Boston Sabres series. The 06 and the 07 playoff series were the same but reversed. Ottawa just won the overtime games.
Mm.
You know, they were the same games, the same competition. The Sabres tied game two with, like, Danny Briere scored in the last minute with the goalie pulled, lost in overtime. You know, they lost game five in overtime. You know, so it's a very similar series. They just didn't win the overtime game. So, flame out, okay, fair enough. I mean, they're a President's Championship team who with huge expectations. But Ottawa was as good as them those 2 years, and they played twice in the playoffs, and they split them. So...
I think Ottawa in 06 was a stronger team because they still had Chara at that point, and I think that makes a huge difference, even though they went further the following year when he was gone. But
They were the two best teams those 2 years, you know what I mean, in the conference.
Yeah.
Was Ottawa and Buffalo. And it was kind of like when Detroit and Colorado would always have to play, right? And whoever would win would usually go on to the Cup. Unfortunately for us, playing Ottawa in the second round and losing Tim Connolly, and losing Dmitri Kukulin in that series, they just didn't have enough at the end, you know, because right away in the conference finals, Henrik Talinder broke his arm, you know, they just couldn't not get injured, you know, and then of course that staph infection Jay McKee woke up with, he told me on the Sportscasters, he got that cut in the Ottawa series. So it waited, you know, until game seven of the next series to bother him at all.
Yeah.
You know, and he was life-threatening illness. Like, his wife was driving him to the hospital. He thought he was going to die. So, fuck,
I mean, that team basically had it all except for superior defensive depth. I mean, you had Ryan Miller in net. Your backup goalie is Martin Biron, who is a competent starter in the league at the very least. But in kind of looking back, I was surprised to see that Maxime Afinogenov was actually the leading point scorer on that team, and that's partly a function of Briere being injured for part of the season, and he only played 48 games. But when the playoffs rolled around, he's Mr. Clutch for them, like you said.
Yeah, he was awesome. Drury was awesome. They were a great team, and you know what? I'll even defend their defensive depth. It wasn't bad. It's just that it wasn't 10 deep. You know what I mean? Like, they had decent depth. But depth can only go so far. You know what I mean? Like, you only have so many guys. And when you got, you know, when your best defenseman on the ice is your number four defenseman, you know, and Campbell's better than the number four defenseman. But my point is that, you know, four guys are out. So you're down to your one pair of NHL defensemen. You know,
yeah.
And then you have to come up with two pairs that nobody has that depth. No one. You know, no team in the world. But
right.
Great team. I love them. I think of them finally. I wish they could have finished it. Would have been amazing. But it doesn't make me like them less. They were an awesome team. And 07 was great too. They're in my honorable mention. Could have made the list. But I already had a couple other Sabres teams I wanted to put slightly ahead of them. But yeah, great couple of years. Hopefully someday we can play games like that again. That'd be really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know the feeling about just coming up short because I'm staring at some posters on the wall of a certain team that came up one game short this year that, I will confess, did not make my list. But if they had won that final game, they probably would have been number one. as amazing as it would be, this year's Bruins would have been number one. But
who are your number three?
For number three, now, everybody hates the Patriots, unless, of course, you're a Patriots fan. And you knew that they were going to turn up on my list. But the question is, which of the teams, because, you know, they've had so much success. And I chose
Wait,
the
can
2000.
I can I guess?
Oh, go ahead.
It's got to be the first one, right? The one that.
Oh, no. They were already on
oh,
there.
Oh, they were already six. On there. Okay, yes. So one more. All right, then the one that beat the Panthers, whatever year that was, 03, 04.
Okay. Those two teams, 01 and 03, and I mentioned this in part one of this podcast, They suffer from, I was not living in the Boston area.
That's right.
The Patriots were not on Sunday Night Football three times a year during that time. In fact, I think Sunday Night Football was still on ESPN at that point and was actually secondary to Monday night. So I didn't get to see all the games. So this is actually from more recent vintage. This would be the Deflategate, Revenge Tour team, the 2016 New England Patriots. So it was
my favorite Patriots team of all time. Why didn't I say that?
Well, you like them mainly for their final game,
yes,
which was something completely out of character for that team, because the first thing that comes to mind is the Brady suspension, one of the most unjust things I've ever seen in my life.
Anybody
who can be somewhat objective about it knows that, you know, the ideal gas law, I mean...
Just read Dan Wetzel on this. Dan Wetzel, totally biased. Look up Dan Wetzel, Deflategate. He'll said it. Nobody wrote about it better. Nobody followed it closer. Read his stuff and then try to tell me it's legit. And I'll be shocked. Nobody who's being objective can read his stuff on this and not think it was just idiotic bullshit. But go ahead.
I was so upset by it that I boycotted the NFL for the first 4 weeks of the season, coinciding with Brady's suspension, and just hated my now good friend Roger Goodell, because I'm actually staring at an autographed football that was given to me a couple of Christmases ago that says, "To Pete, Merry Christmas, Roger Goodell."
Ew.
So if you had any questions about Roger Goodell, he's a Merry Christmas guy and not a Happy Holidays.
Well,
so
I like that, but screw
yeah. but okay, so you get past those first four games. The Patriots were 3-1. They had Jacoby Brissett starting the last two games because Jimmy Garoppolo apparently does not know how to play the quarterback position without getting himself hurt. We learned that even further last year. When Brady comes back the fifth game of the season in Cleveland, which they won by 20 points, they still had seven road games left. And wouldn't you know that they went 7-0 in those road games? Their only loss the rest of the season was, oddly enough, a home game to the Seahawks, 31-24 on a Sunday night, where clearly the Seahawks were out for revenge.
Yep, I remember the
49,
game. Mm-hmm.
And the way that they lost that, it was actually they stopped the Patriots on the goal line at the end of the game in kind of a neat little twist, although it didn't feel that way at the time. The team roll into the playoffs. They have their usual divisional game against Houston where they rock them. They dominate Pittsburgh in the second half, win 36-17. So going into the Super Bowl against Atlanta, I'm trying to remember what the point spread was for that game. Just kind of quickly, I want to say it was 7. No, it was only 3, apparently. But it feels like that the Patriots were a much more dominant team than that Falcons team, just kind of thinking back. And we all know what kind of happened. I mean, you know, I had a party at my house and people started to leave at 21-0. And some of my friends' kids were being obnoxious. So I had to take them to my basement and put on the 1993 Royal Rumble to like get them away from my other friends because they were threatening to leave. And
why 93? So, why'd you pick that one?
Okay. I did not pick that one, okay. But, they were, I think at the time, 9 and 10 years old. And they said, "Can you put on the 93? Cause we don't know who won that."
Okay.
And I thought, "Oh, well, you're in for a real treat," while in the back of my head thinking, "Wow, the criticism of that is that everybody knew Yokozuna was going to win." So it's kind of funny. And as I put that on for them, Atlanta scored to make it 28-3. And the Patriots had their long drive, the famous 2:12 left fourth quarter. And I emerged back upstairs after watching a little bit of the Rumble match myself. And when the Patriots scored a touchdown, like, okay, all right, fine, we're going to maybe make this respectable. But when they missed the extra point, I freaked out. And yet I pumped my fist because I had made an imaginary prop bet saying that there would be a missed extra point in the game. So everybody looked at me like, "What the hell is wrong with you?" They're trying to come back in this game. But when it comes to miraculous comebacks, I mean, how can you really top that. I mean, yeah, the Bills came back from 30. The Bills came back from 35-3,
and that was awesome. I'm not a Bills fan, but that was awesome.
They got some help with some turnovers by Houston, and also the Oilers being a flawed team.
Wasn't there a huge turnover in the Patriots game? Wasn't it Hightower? Well,
there was when it was 28-12, and you get the strip sack because Freeman didn't come out and chip Hightower as he just kind of went in unimpeded on Matt Ryan, although you could say maybe Matt Ryan could have seen him and just get rid of the ball. But, you know, so many different things happened in that game where if it goes differently, the Atlanta Falcons win that Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And I know, I know it made you, your vindictiveness towards the Atlanta Hawks is shocking to me. And I felt great hatred for the Yankees, the Canadiens, and all of that. But your hatred for the Atlanta Falcons, considering that you're a Saints fan in Buffalo, New York, that's some purebred stuff. And I have to give you a round of applause for that. I definitely enjoy it when you pick on them. Although I did feel somewhat bad, and then I woke up still drunk the next morning.
the best $10 I ever spent in my life. I mean, we say these things and it's exaggeration, but I think I stand by it. The best $10 I ever spent was during the summer. Saints fans took up a collection to buy a billboard for the month of September to post right near the stadium, the new Falcons stadium, where if you wanted to walk into the stadium, you had to walk by it. And it simply said 28-3. And it stayed there in all its glory for September. Man, did I love it. And it was a great $10 spent.
And I think that comeback kind of takes attention away from how dominant that Patriots team was during the rest of the season. I mean, do you realize? I mean, they went 8-0 on the road because they won the opening game with Garoppolo starting in Arizona. I mean, how many teams go 8-0 on the road? That almost never happens in the NFL. But they managed to do it.
Awesome moment in that Super Bowl. My favorite moment has got to be Home Depot guy coming down to the sideline to be there to see his team win with his like 25-year-old girlfriend.
Arthur Blank,
yeah.
Yes.
I wonder if they're still standing there. Like, do you think they're still standing on that sideline waiting to win the Super Bowl?
You know, they might be, although I'm hesitant to pick on NFL owners considering that Robert Kraft, may have had a thing going on. But that's a completely separate conversation with his love of massage parlors, or so it seems.
Well, luckily for me, Gail Benson is a saint. You know, not a New Orleans saint, but, you know, a religious saint.
Yes.
God bless you, Gail Benson. Yeah. All right. Anything else on that team?
No.
All right. Screw you, Falcons. All right. My number two team.
Oh, before we get to number two.
Oh, we got to do our hated teams.
I had an idea. Like, we're talking about these teams that we like so much, and I had just mentioned your general loathing for the Atlanta Falcons, and just to pick one, just one. The one single season team that you've hated the most. Who would that be for you?
Well, I know the team, but I'm looking up the year. because I'm not quite sure, you know, is it this or that, you know what I mean? But I know how to find out. And it's a team that somehow went into Lambeau Field and won a playoff game as a road team.
That you must be referring to the 2002 Atlanta Falcons.
Yes. Easily my most hated team of all time. I hated Michael Vick. that dog killing piece of shit. Hated him so much. So glad to see his demise. Hated this team. Wanted so badly for them to lose in the playoffs, and then of course they beat the Patriots, which was so disappointing, but then eventually they did lose. I can't remember to who, but yeah, it's definitely a Falcons team, and it's definitely a Michael Vick Falcons team, and that one sticks out as my most hated because the Saints Well, they could be on a possibly a most hated team. That Saints team that year, they started like 7-2. They were awesome. They beat the eventual Super Bowl champions twice, and then Aaron Brooks got hurt. But they kept playing them. They weren't putting Delhomme in, and they lost the last three games, including one to Cincinnati, who like won two games all year, and they didn't even make the playoffs. And then, of course, Atlanta slides in into that spot, and they win a playoff game. Ugh, such a nightmare. Definitely that Falcons team.
Now, for me, as much as I would like to pick the 1972 Miami Dolphins, even though I wasn't alive, and may Mercury Morris, well, whatever, I'm not going to say it, but suffice it to say that what the 2007 Patriots did was far more impressive, even though they lost the last game, than what the 72 Dolphins did with their easy-ass schedule with two teams that won two games on the season in their division. But anyway, my most loathed team, and this is certainly a function of too much YouTube watching on my part, the 1986-87 Detroit Pistons. I hate that fucking team so much. And yeah, I'm going to drop an F-bomb because that is how much I hate them. I hate Isaiah. Like to the absolute core. I'm so glad he's failed. He ran the CBA into the ground. He ran the Knicks into the ground. He ran pretty much everything into the ground. And then I said, oh, people only pay attention to Larry Bird because he's a white guy. Oh, give me a break. I mean, there's so much stuff from the 87 playoffs between the Pistons and the Celtics and the genuine hatred, them stomping Kevin McHale's foot that had a stress fracture in it. That basically derailed his career. Lambeer starting fight after fight with Bird in game four, and then him getting his comeuppance, getting punched by Robert Parrish. And then all these other guys are Rick Mahorn, Dennis Rodman as a rookie before he started coloring his hair. I mean, there's so many loathsome characters on that team, and yet they were coached by Chuck Daly, who was the coach of the 92 Dream Team, one of my favorite teams. It just... There seems like a certain difference there, but God, I hate those guys like so much. Oh, and I'm glad the Celtics beat them in Game 7.
Wasn't there a 30-for-30 on them?
There was one on the Bad Boys in general.
In general,
but I think
yeah.
There might have been more focus on the two title teams.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting pick. I like it. A lot of passion in the hate from both of us. I like that. Maybe someday we'll do a most hated teams list.
You would have thought I would have picked a Yankees team or the 2011 Canadiens or really any Canadiens team, but no. Oddly enough, it's the 87 Detroit Pistons that I hate more than any other.
I stayed on brand and picked the Falcons team, so.
Yeah.
All right. let's go to my number 2. A glorious squad. The 2009-2010 New Orleans Saints Super Bowl 44 champions. I've often said that Drew Brees has made all of my dreams as a sports fan come true. And this is the year it happened. They started 13-0. 13 wins in a row to start a season, which is more wins than any Saints team had ever won at the time. Right out of the gate. I apologize, but one of my favorite games was the Monday night game against the Patriots, only because it was like the Patriots, right? They were the gold standard, and it's like, well, are we this good? You know, can we stand up to these guys? And I remember there's a moment in that game where Devery Henderson scores a long touchdown, and he catches it, and you would have needed a 100-yard TV to see a Patriot in the screen. Like, he just got so open. It's such a cool moment in the season. There's the moment where Robert Meacham in Washington strips an interceptor of a Drew Brees pass, strips the ball out of his hands and returns it for a touchdown. And they win that game because the kicker for the Redskins missed like a 25 yarder that would have put him up 10 in the last minute. but wow, what a cool team. And then they lose the last three games. Now the third game they lost because they didn't play anyone because they had already clinched home field. But I was a little nervous. And then the Cardinals scored first in the playoff game. They go up 7-0. Pretty long run, if I recall, by Tim Hightower, I believe. But
yep,
then
70 yards.
Yeah, Reggie Bush plays just an amazing Reggie Bush game. Long punt return, long touchdown rushing. They win that game. They win the NFC Championship game in a thriller in overtime that actually ended up being the game where they changed the rules to allow each team to possess the ball once. And then the Super Bowl against Peyton Manning, you know, the pick six, Tracy Porter. And I should mention that in my life at this time, I was pretty sick. I got sick and was in the hospital for the St. Louis game, which I think was in November sometime. I was in the hospital with a pneumonia, and they decided I was going to need the surgery. I had the surgery like in January. So during the playoff games, like, my mom was like a nervous wreck. It's like, tell my brother Greg, like, oh, you got to sit next to him at all times to make sure he, you know, doesn't get out of control and stays in his seat. And I did pretty good until Tracy Porter picked off that Peyton Manning pass. And then not even Greg could keep me pinned to the couch. And I allowed myself to enjoy it. I think I was screaming over and over, holy shit, we're going to win the Super Bowl. My friend's wife was there with her trumpet playing When the Saints Come Marching In after every time the Saints scored. And I just remember hearing it in the background. And wow, what a fun team. What a fun year. I still can't believe the Saints won the Super Bowl. I can't believe it happened, but it did. It happened in 2009 thanks to Drew Brees and Sean Payton. And Marcus Colston and all the great players, Fujita, Vilma, Porter, obviously, Jabari Greer, just 53 guys that I hold really close to my heart. Love the 2009-2010 Saints. And there's only one way that they wouldn't crack the number one on this list. And I'll tell you all about that in a few minutes.
Okay. And like in looking like through there, my main memory of them is when they got to 13-0 and when they lost.
Yeah. Saturday night game.
Yeah. They were not, actually, you know, at the time thinking, were they not trying to go 16-0? But now I remember the Colts were in a similar situation where
I think they won 14 to start. Maybe.
I think they went 14-0, and then they decided to call off the dogs at that point. And I'm of the belief that you should just go for it if you have a chance to do something that, you know, never happens. You should always try to take that opportunity. But I remember that Patriots game very well. It's the because they were doing the some sort of documentary on Bill Belichick for that one season in 09, which coincidentally was the worst Patriots season with Brady, at least since 2002. And the Saints just absolutely destroyed them, 38-17, not even close. And there's a clip of Brady saying, you know, we're just not good enough. But I kind of take that to mean, you know, that Saints team was so good and so fearless because – The iconic moment in the Super Bowl, an onside kick.
Yeah, ambush.
I mean, the grapefruits on Sean Payton to do something like that on that kind of stage to, you know, on the hopes of maybe we can steal a possession away from Peyton Manning. And that's exactly what they did. But as it turns out, like Tracy Porter with the big interception and me being a resident Indianapolis Colts hater of the time. I mean, they would certainly make one of my least favorite teams lists, one of the Manning Colts teams. But the Saints winning that Super Bowl over Manning and the Colts, it almost felt like my team won the Super Bowl because I was rooting for them so hard in that game.
They beat Warner, Favre, and Manning, all Hall of Fame quarterbacks, to win the Super Bowl. And Tracy Porter, interestingly, the only player on the team from Louisiana was the one who made the big play there in the Super Bowl. What do you got for number two, buddy?
For number two, I have this team probably could have been my number one, but again, I was only 7 years old when they won the NBA title. The 1985-86 Boston Celtics. Now, I know that you're not a huge NBA guy, and I don't know how much you necessarily know about this team.
Not a lot.
Okay.
Just like what I learned in like the Lakers-Celtics documentary, you know, just like things I've read. You know, I don't. I just know them in a historical sense, not very up close, more broad.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a super team because the only big acquisition they had for that year was Bill Walton. More on him in a second. They went 40-1 at home that regular season. The one loss was to Portland by about 17 points. That was the only game that they lost by more than 10 points for the entire season. And in fact, they went 67-15. And that 15 was kind of a product of them getting bored against mediocre teams. I mean, you had these storylines like Larry Bird deciding to play a game left-handed against the Portland Trailblazers. And when asked why he did that, he said, "I'm saving my right hand for the Lakers on Sunday." I mean, this is Larry Bird at his absolute apex, playing with a prime Kevin McHale, who did get hurt in midseason, Robert Parrish, who, you know, he was still an old guy at that point. He was about 35, 36 years old, even then. I might be mixing up the ages in my head. Dennis Johnson, a young Danny Ainge, and I had mentioned Bill Walton, which it was the healthiest season of his career. And I have the contention that no single athlete in all of sports history has ever been happier in a situation than Bill Walton was on the 1986 Boston Celtics. He was so happy to be there and healthy and contributing. And the joy that he had, like, it translates through when I watch clips of this team on YouTube. And I'm not just saying that because I posted the 86 Celtics video yearbook on my YouTube channel. There's a 6-minute video of just Larry Bird and Bill Walton pick and rolls that I literally watch about every 3 weeks because they just made it look so damn easy. Like I said, by the way, if you include the playoffs, they went 50-1 at home. Imagine being a season ticket holder for that team and you go to all the games.
That's awesome. And they only lose one
of them. They lost to Portland.
Okay.
And it was the only game where they truly got blown out in the regular season. They beat every other team in the NBA. They had at least one win against every team from the Western Conference. This is probably Larry Bird's greatest season overall. They go through the playoffs. They sweep the Jordan Bulls, although he didn't have the supporting cast then. They roll Atlanta in 5 games. That's the most memorable for Game 5, where it was a fairly close game. It was about 9-point game in the third quarter, and the Celtics went on a 36-6 run, including 24 straight points. As if that sequence is pretty famous. That's on YouTube. And then they swept Milwaukee in the conference finals. Nice little revenge for getting swept by them in 1983. But the only thing lacking from that season is when they got to the finals, the Lakers did not show up for their beating in 86, and they lost to the Rockets in 5 games. But that Rockets team, they were kind of the real deal. They took the Celtics to 6 games. The fact that they were able to win 2 out of the 3 in Houston kind of speaks to them, although that cheap shot artist, Ralph Sampson, starting a fight with Jerry Seasting, who is – only 15 inches shorter than him, and that kind of led to the madness that was Game 5. But Game 6 in the Boston Garden, Larry Bird himself said that it was the greatest game that he ever played. The place is going bananas. They intimidated the hell out of Ralph Sampson. I mean, everything about that team, whether it be, you know, Bird, McHale, you know, your big three, all the way down to Sam Vincent, David Thirdkill, Scott Wedman, all those guys, you know, kind of at the back end of the roster. It just brings me such joy to watch it, and that's why I return to it again and again.
Beautiful. Cool team. Did you get to go see him play?
I never got to a Celtics game until 87. As a matter of fact, though, the Celtics home games at that time were airing on the local sports channel, Sports Channel New England. I don't know if they had sports. Do they have Sports Channel New York up by you?
No.
Yeah,
we had something called the Empire Sports Network, which is probably similar.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So the Celtics games aired on Sports Channel, and it was a pay channel, and we only got NESN because my dad wanted the Bruins and the Red Sox. He didn't care as much about the Celtics. And I went, and this may have been during the 86 season, I went to an autograph signing at the mall in my hometown where Bill Walton was signing autographs. And I told Big Bill that I couldn't watch the game the next night because my parents didn't have a Sports Channel. So Bill Walton kind of shamed my parents into eventually getting Sports Channel, because I kind of used that as ammunition. And as I sit in my basement recording this, I have to turn around in my chair. I'm looking at my Celtics pennant that I have hanging on the wall, autographed by Bill Walton. And it's one of my most prized pieces of sports memorabilia that I have.
I was lucky enough to see the 09-10 Saints. They played here in Buffalo.
Week
three or four, something like that. So I did go to that game. So I did get to see the champs play early in that season, which is cool. But yeah. All right, let's take a break. Let's build the drama. And when we come back, we will reveal our number one teams of all time.
Dark tonight. A little bit weaker than you used to be.
All right, we are back. The Adams Division Podcast. We've been counting down our top 10 favorite sports teams of all time. And real quickly, we just wanted to thank some of our friends at Place to Be Nation. Before we do that, I wanted to mention the sportscasters. Don't forget about my podcast. I mentioned that recently some of the guests are Stuart Mandel, Mike Triplett has been on recently, and Richard Deitch is coming up real soon, along with a wrestling guest that if anyone listens to wrestling podcasts, you've certainly heard his Southern drawl before. All right. we will. Go ahead, Peter. What's up with Greetings from Allentown? And you got some Place to Be plugs, too.
Yeah. Greetings from Allentown. They got coming up a primetime wrestling from 1991. I've only done one of those before, which would be the August 12th edition, the Macho Man's Bachelor Party. And the episode I got out now is on Central States Wrestling from March 10th, 1984. Somehow managed to pick the one Kansas City show that has no references to Harley Race. I don't know how I managed to do that, but it's kind of an ongoing thing as I go through the episode. And you'd mentioned Place to Be Nation, and I do want to say a few words about our friends on the Place to Be Pop feed. I never say it correctly. I can never say it like Chad Campbell does. The Place to Be Pop feed coming out. We got the Marvel Age podcast and the DC Comics as well. It's a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans, I must say. And this week we got the Year in Pop 1977 with Andy Atherton and Scott Criscolo, two guys who were actually alive in 1977. I certainly can't say that, but
I was negative three.
I kind of wanted to say I remember 1977. I remember going to concerts and I saw the Led Zeppelin, but that reference might be lost on people because that's the Everclear song AM Radio, and it's entirely possible I might be the only person who remembers that one. But also on the Pop feed, you got other great shows such as Geek and Sassy, Looking Forward, Looking Back, which featured yours truly a couple of weeks back, looking ahead at the NFL season and looking back at the NBA and NHL seasons.
Okay.
And I already plugged this Year in Pop, so
that means it's up to me. The wrestling feed.
Yes.
The main
yes.
feed, and of course one of the great podcasts of all time, The Place to Be Nation flagship show. You were on the latest one. I will be on September 30th, so probably a few episodes from now. Check that out. Scott also has the Main Event podcast. There's a new episode of that going up on August 30th. What else is on that feed? The Ticket Show, right? Row 1, Seat 1. Row 1, Seat 1 is on that feed, too. They had some football talk on 824, but they're going to go back to their normal format. I heard Justin say after that. And I think that kind of covers it. There's other stuff on there. You Don't Know Billy Jack is on there. Good show. Billy Jerk, I think, would have been a better title. But The Place to Be Nation, Pop Feed, and Main Feed. We're on there, so check us out on there. And thanks to Justin and Scott. All right. With all that said, do you think I missed a big one? Anything else I should have said?
Well, I don't know. Peter? I did a pretty terrible job getting through it. And if I don't mention Talk and Pop and Freak Out Drive-In, Jenny will probably cut my balls off or something to that effect. Also, Extreme Three-Way Dance, a newish show on the Place to Be Wrestling feed for all your ECW needs, because if there's one complaint that I get from my show from time to time, it's that I don't do enough ECW, which I think part of it is I get annoyed by the fact that they don't have the original music, because it was so integral to the experience of ECW at the time from when I was watching it.
Taz coming out to that Kiss song. I know it's not Enter Sandman, which many people would think of first, but man, that was an awesome scene to be in. I'm pretty proud of the fact that I can say I've never been asked to be on a single Place to Be Nation podcast other than the main one.
Oh.
Never one time have I been asked. So congratulations to me. All right. Before I give out my number one, I want to recap my list real quick. Number 10, 93-94 Rangers. Number 9, the world champion, 89 A's. Number 8, the 2008-2009 Oklahoma Sooners. Number 7, 11-12 Saints. Number 6, the world champion, Braves from 1995. Number 5, the 92-93 Sabres. Number 4, the 18-19 Saints. Number 3, the 05-06 Sabres. And shockingly, maybe to some, number 2, the 09-10 Saints. Now, how possibly could they be kept off of the top slot? I assume you know, Peter, but my number one team is the 2012-2013 Yale Bulldogs ice hockey team, the national champion Yale Bulldog ice hockey team. Let me tell you a story. Boston College, way back in the late 90s, early 2000s, they really started doing a lot of recruiting in Buffalo, and they recruited two guys in particular. One was Jeff Farkas, and the other was Brian Gianta, who was technically from Rochester but played his youth hockey in Buffalo. He was on the Junior Sabres, and he was basically a Buffalo hockey player from Rochester. But those two guys went to BC, big recruits, like five-star hockey recruits. And they went there to win the national championship. BC hadn't won one in years and years and years, 40, 50 years, something like that. Been a long drought. And Farkas never got the job done. Came close, Final Fours, championship games, couldn't win it. And it got to the senior year for Gianta, who was 1 year behind Farkas. So that team, I just remember my brother Anthony and I watching the championship game. We were at a party. My dad's friend had a party, and we said we wanted to watch this game. And he's like, well, you can go in there. There's a little TV in there. And it was literally a 13-inch color TV back when, you know, you wouldn't be that rare to watch something on a 13-inch color TV.
Yeah.
And my brother and I, who was 11 years younger than me, we sat and we watched this game, which went to overtime. And we watched BC win the national championship in overtime. Finally, you know, the monkey was off their back, you know. And it was such a cool thing, and me and my brother just watched them celebrate and talked about how awesome it was and how cool it would be, you know, to play in the tournament even, you know, or to play D1 hockey. And fast forward all these years later, and it turns out my brother has a chance to play D1 hockey, and he's playing a game in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And he looks over at his bench, and Jerry York is standing on the bench. And Jerry York is there because he came to watch him play. And, you know, the next day, some big, like, connected hockey players or hockey people in Buffalo were messaging my brother, and they're saying, like, congratulations on BC. That's so cool. Now, he hadn't heard back from BC yet, but based on the people who were saying this, we assumed he was going to get a full offer from BC and he was going to take it. Well, later in that day, it turns out they offered him a 3-for-4. So basically, they guarantee the 3 years of the scholarship, and they'll talk to you later about the fourth. And it was all of my brother's other offers were full. So he was like, you know, as much as I always wanted to go to BC, as much as I basically turned down RPI just for a chance to go on the recruiting trip to BC, where the player that he stayed with on the recruiting trip was, I can't think of his name. The Rangers player, Chris Kreider.
Yeah.
That's who hosted him. And then, you know, like I said, Jerry York came to the game, whatever. So he ended up going to Yale, turning them down, going to Yale. And freshman year, they didn't make the tournament. At sophomore year, they played a game in BC. And they should have won and didn't. They tied the game. But it was a big moment where they had tied the defending national champions in their arena. And then they went to Colorado to play Colorado College and Denver, two big teams out west, and won both of those games. And they kind of were home for Christmas thinking, we can beat anyone in the country, we can win the national championship. So you fast forward a little bit further into the season, and their starting goaltender hurts his knee, he's out of the lineup, and they lose 6 straight games. And I'm in the hospital at the time. And my brother calls me, and I've never heard him so defeated. He's like, I don't want to be here. I made the wrong choice. We can't win a game. We're not going to make the tournament. Kenny's going to leave. Kenny Agostino is going to leave. You know, it says all, you know, just everything you could think of. It was bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, look at dude. Could be worse. You know, you could be me. And, you know, you're spending your days in the hospital. Like, it's not that bad. You're getting pampered at one of the great universities in the world. Like, tough it up. You guys will be in Pittsburgh. I'll get ready here, and I'll meet you there. Because Pittsburgh is where the Frozen Four was. So I kind of talked him off the ledge. Starting goalie came back. They got hot. They won 6 games in a row. And then they went to Atlantic City for the ECAC championships, a virtual lock to make the tournament. Well, they screw that up. They lose both games. And they need Notre Dame to beat Michigan on the last game of the season and end Michigan's 23 straight years in the tournament to find a way in. Notre Dame wins the game. They get in the tournament. They're the last seed. They beat Minnesota in the first game in overtime. They beat North Dakota in the second game, which is maybe the best game my brother ever played in his life. 2 third period assists. They win that game. They go to the Frozen Four. So here we are at the Frozen Four, just like I told them. They're playing the Hockey East regular season champion and playoff champions in Massachusetts Lowell. They beat that in overtime. Andrew Miller, the greatest Yale hockey player of all time, scores in overtime to beat them. In a game where by the time Yale finally won, I think it was 7 minutes in overtime, Mass Lowell hadn't recorded a shot on goal in the game since there was 9 minutes left in the third period.
Wow.
And they go to the championship to play Quinnipiac, a conference rival, a state rival, a team that had beat them 3 times already. And I remember I woke up that day and I had this feeling like, oh my God, he's going to probably finish second again. Because my brother had finished second in 3 state championships, a prep championship, countless other tournaments across Canada growing up. He's a second place guy. A lot of second place trophies. A lot of silver medals. And I just kind of had that feeling. I remember just kind of thinking like, man, I just hope there's some way that doesn't end that way again. And some way it didn't. They won 4-0. They beat 3 number 1 seeds and a number 2 seed to win the national championship, which I think they're the only team that's ever done that. An unbelievable run and an unbelievable moment where the confetti was falling down in Pittsburgh, and I was thinking about that night way back when and watching that little TV with my little brother, watching BC win the championship and saying, wow, wouldn't this be cool? and it actually happened, like a dream actually came true. And it was one of the greatest moments of my life. And despite everything I had been through that year, I had to have a bowel resectioning. I spent January 28th to March 14th in the hospital, had major surgery. Didn't matter. It was all erased. And that night at the hotel, we took a picture. My brother Anthony, myself, and my brother Greg, we didn't know the picture was being taken. We were just saying goodnight to each other because I had to go back to my friend Matt's house where I was staying. I had used all the energy I had for that day. My uncle snapped the picture, and somehow that ended up being like a sensation online thanks to Richard Deitch. And we went viral. We were on CNN.com and E!News.com and the CBS Evening News and Good Morning America. The picture was everywhere. And there was a cover story about me and Anthony in the New Haven Register. Just a really unbelievable season, an unbelievable moment. It wasn't my brother's best season statistically. He didn't score a lot of goals. They didn't ask him to. They're asking him to do something else. But when it really mattered, he played his best game in the regional final against North Dakota. And, you know, just unbelievable, an unbelievable team, an unbelievable moment in my life, in my family's life, something we'll never forget. And that's why the Yale Bulldogs from 2012, 2013 were the national champions. And if you ever go to Ingles Rink, be sure to take a look at the banner. It's there forever. It flies there forever. And I'm proud of that. My brother's proud of that. He's got a beautiful championship ring that he never wears. But yeah, unbelievable. Very cool. The only possible way the Saints could have been bumped. It happened in 2013. With the Yale Bulldogs. And actually, I did a 4-part documentary on the sportscasters at the 5-year anniversary, where each game, we went through each game with two guys from the team, usually the stars of the game, like the Mass Lowell game, I had Andrew Miller on, who scored the winning goal. You know, the championship game, I had Jeff Malcolm, the goalie, on, who had a shutout, and also an interview with Keith Elaine, the coach. So that's really cool if you want to check that out. That's on the sportscasters feed. But that's my story. That's my number one, the Yale Bulldogs hockey team from 2013.
That type of thing is always so much better when there's a personal attachment. But to your point, your brother did get into the box score in the national championship game. Do you remember how?
Do you have a penalty?
He served a too many men on the ice penalty midway through the second period.
I was going to say, I didn't think he had a penalty.
Well, you know, sometimes in the box score they don't list who served the penalty, but sometimes they do. And indeed he served that. But you know, being part of a championship team, you can never take that away from him, even if he doesn't wear the ring.
He's one of the few players who played in every game that season too. I think there was like 3 or 4 of them played in every single game. Like I said, it wasn't his best season statistically, but he was a sophomore and he was playing a non-scoring role, and he actually scored in the BC game, but he didn't get credit for it, and they gave it to someone, a senior, who was his first ever goal, and he's like, I'm not going in there and saying, like, oh, I tip that. You know what I mean? He's like, he can just have that one, like, whatever. But kind of a funny thing about being in the box score, the next year they played Harvard at Madison Square Garden, right? And it's another whole story, like, we went to a game together there, and it's so cool to see him play there. And like, the second goal is scored by a Boston kid named Mike Doherty on an assist by Anthony. So I'm so excited to hear his name on the loudspeaker, right? And they're like, Yale goal scored by number 24, Michael Doherty, assisted by number 19, Jimmy Vesey. Doherty from Vesey at, so they read the 19 on the other team.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? No wonder why you have it out for Jimmy VC so much.
Isn't that crazy? God.
Yeah. I mean, you have enough. Well, I guess you don't have it out for him anymore because he's a Buffalo Sabre.
He's still dead to me. Yeah. He's going to have to score like Game 7 in the Stanley Cup final overtime to like get out of this hole. But yeah, cool. What a year, you know. And like, it's just so cool too that like we somehow went viral in relation to the championship too. Then I remember like the next year I was watching like the Dartmouth game, and then, and like Anthony came up and the announcer's like, Anthony had an interesting offseason. Him and his brothers were, you know, went viral. And, like, he's, like, telling the story. I'm like, this is so cool. This is, like, the coolest thing that's ever going to happen in my life. So, thanks to Richard Deitch for that. Actually, talking to Richard Friday. So,
yes. Yeah,
that was very cool. All right, what do you got? Recap your list first, if you have it in front of you. And then give me number one.
Oh, I do. Number 10, 1993 Atlanta Braves. Number 9, the 1990 Cincinnati Bengals. Number 8, the 1995 Houston Rockets. Number 7, the 2004 Boston Red Sox. Number 6, 2001 New England Patriots. Number 5, the 1986 Boston Red Sox. Number 4, the 1992 U.S. Men's Olympic Basketball Team, the original Dream Team. Number 3, the 2016 New England Patriots. And at number 2, the 1985-86 Boston Celtics. And for anybody who knows me and knows how my kind of identity is wrapped up around one franchise, I mean, for those who follow my civilian Twitter account, it has the team's name in the handle. The fact that I have yet to mention the Boston Bruins is kind of the elephant in the room. So, with that in mind, clearly my number one is the 2010-2011 Stanley Cup champion, Boston Bruins.
Game 7 winners.
They managed to get it done in a Game 7, albeit on the road in Vancouver with, I'm not sure if you know this story or even remember who this guy is. Do you know the gangster Whitey Bulger? Or is that like a too much of a Boston thing?
No, I know his story for sure.
He was one of the FBI's 10 most wanted people on the list with Bin Laden had just been killed during that playoffs. It's amazing how I think of it. Like, yeah, Bin Laden was killed during the 2011 Cup playoffs. But he actually he was found in Santa Monica, and he actually snuck up to Vancouver to go to Game 7 is what the story is.
That's awesome.
And then he got busted in Santa Monica 8 days later. I mean, I absolutely love that story. A loathsome human being, but enough of a hockey fan that he was going to go up there and do that. Now, I was fortunate enough to go to a hell of a lot of games that season. 38 home games, one unfortunate road game at the Nassau Coliseum that the Islanders beat the Bruins. And all the home games in the playoffs, I believe there were 13 of them back when this was before the NHL figured out that they could charge season ticket holders whatever the hell they want for the playoffs because they knew we were going to pay it. I mean, I think per game, the Stanley Cup final was $73, which sounds like a lot, but, you know, I've paid more than that to go to pretty much every Springsteen concert that I've ever been to. That team the year before had blown a 3-0 lead in the playoffs rather infamously to Philadelphia. And while they may have had an excuse of injuries and guys coming back from injury by Philadelphia, I mean, the fact was that that stink was kind of hanging over that team going into the next season. And to his credit, the now much maligned and deservedly so Peter Chiarelli definitely did not screw up that offseason for the Bruins. They got the they had the draft pick to take Tyler Seguin second overall. They made the trade with that having that pick allowed them to move their first round pick and Dennis Wiedemann and his somewhat onerous contract in exchange for Nathan Horton and Gregory Campbell, two guys who would be major contributors on this team. Now, when it comes to Stanley Cup champions, they might not be, I guess, the strongest one that anybody has ever seen. They only won 46 games in the regular season. They finished with only 103 points, which, by the way, was four more points than the 2019 Blues. I don't know why I feel the need to point that out, but I do. But there were so many exciting games in that regular season. The blood rivalry with the Canadiens, with Max Pacioretty getting introduced to the stanchion by Zdeno Chara on what I termed a clean hit, but caused Montreal fans to call 911 or whatever the emergency number is up in Quebec to report him to the police and that whole madness. You had the rivalry with the Flyers dating back to the year before. That was still going strong. And then two games in Pittsburgh where the Bruins came back from multi-goal deficits in the third period to win. So many exciting games in that season where I could probably do an hour and a half podcast just on that team and probably still leave a bunch of stuff on the table. The Stanley Cup final, the fact that they won all three of the home games after Nathan Horton was put out the way he was by Aaron Rome. But not even to forget the two Game 7s earlier in that playoffs. An overtime Game 7 victory over the Montreal Canadiens, where everybody was kind of mildly expecting the worst because we had seen that kind of thing happen with Montreal. Even though the Bruins had beaten them in the playoffs before, sweeping them in 09, were kind of conditioned a certain way. And the exciting 1-0 game against Tampa in the conference final, Game 7, the greatest hockey game that I've ever seen in my life. No penalties called on either team. Nothing you could even argue was a penalty. Great goaltending from both sides. Kept that game scoreless until about 7.5 minutes left when they finally broke through the Tampa 1-3-1. I mean, there's so much to love about that team. I have so many posts. I have an entire wall devoted to the 2011 Bruins. I'm not ashamed to say that. I mean, I was saying how the 2013 Yale team is extremely personal for you. And while I'm not related to anybody on the Boston Bruins, it felt deeply personal for me because I'd been a season ticket holder for a long time, dating back most of the years, all the way to 1998. Sat through a lot of cruddy hockey to get to that point. And to see them win that game in some bar near Faneuil Hall on that night in June of 2011, it made it all worth it. And I will tell you this, Steve, at some point for the Buffalo Sabres, probably in the 2025-2026 season I'm projecting, when the Buffalo Sabres win the Stanley Cup and something similar happens to you, I hope that you have those same feelings that I had on that night.
My connection to this team is Nathan Horton. My brother used to be coached by this guy named Daryl Belfry, who was from Fort Erie, Ontario. And Horton is from Welland, Ontario. And Belfry was like his personal coach, was actually at the draft with him and everything. And I would see Nathan Horton all the time, picking my brother up from skates. Anytime Daryl Belfry had ice, Nathan Horton was out there. And my brother used to skate with Nathan all the time. And man, I was scared for him when that happened, but it kind of changed the whole series. Like, almost never thought like the Bruins weren't going to win after that.
It flipped a switch, and the funniest thing was when they got the 5-minute power play as a result of that, the Bruins didn't score on that. And kind of during that intermission, I remember there was a feeling of, well, we're screwed now that we didn't score on that one. And what happened was, the opening faceoff of the second period of Game 3, Vancouver won the faceoff because the official dropped the puck too soon. It was one of those situations where they would have whistled it down and obnoxiously redone it in today's hockey. Amazing how things have changed in 8 years. So they win it back clean to Alex Edler, who handles the puck, and all of a sudden his stick explodes. So this allows David Krejci to charge in, gain possession of the puck. He takes a shot, it rings around, and Andrew Ferentz throws like a miracle wrist shot from the corner of at the blue line, so at the corner of the zone, that somehow eludes Luongo 1-0. And from that point forward, the Bruins scored 20 goals, including that one, in the final 5 games, where Vancouver only scored 4. So even though it was the biggest blowout of a 7-game series that you'll ever see in your life, it was 23-8 for that 7-game series. And everybody talks about, I don't want to hear about the officiating in that series because it went both ways with stuff going on. I mean, I remember Yannick Hansen spearing Adam McQuaid in the nuts with 7 minutes to go in Game 7 and the officials just looking the other way. Spearing him in the nuts. A man doing that to another man. Can you imagine that? I mean, my God. But I mean, you know, nothing'll take away. I mean, I'm staring at Chara holding the Stanley Cup right now. I love having that on my wall.
Well, my iPad says I have 5% left, so we got to start wrapping this down before it dies.
Fans, we're out of time.
We're out of time. Let me ask you this real quickly, though. So this is the only Bruins team on your list. There's three other finalists I can think of. Maybe, right? 90? Did they play the Oilers another time or just now? In your lifetime.
88 and 90.
88 and 90, that's right. So four other finalists. How would you rank the other four?
I would have to go 2019 first, because that team, if they had won Game 7 against St. Louis, would have been number one on my list. 2013, while an immensely frustrating team at times, they would have to rank second because I went to all the games that season. I didn't miss a single home game during that lockout shortened season. And between 88 and 90, it's close, but I have to give the 88 team the edge over 90 because they were the team that finally broke through and beat Montreal, ending a streak of 45 years without beating the Canadiens in the playoffs and 18 consecutive series losses to the hated Habs.
All right, well, we will be back this fall for a special 1994 edition of the Adams Division podcast as part of the Place to Be Nation's 1994 series. And then I would imagine after that, we still have to do the Royal Rumble list because we missed it last year.
Oh, we did, yeah.
Yeah, so we still have that kind of hanging out there. So I think that's where we're headed. Thank you to everyone who listened to all of this talk about our favorite teams the last two episodes, part one, part two. Thanks to Scott and Judd for having us on the Place to Be feed. Don't forget about greetings from Allentown at GF Allentown Pod on Twitter and the Sportscasters at Sports_Casters. On Twitter. We are out.